Welcome to episode 64. As always, you can find the podcast on the web at enterprisehardcorepodcast.com. You'll find all the streaming and social media information on the website. As always, give us a follow on Instagram at Enterprise Hardcore Podcast. You'll find out about the upcoming episodes there, as well as old flyers and upcoming local show flyers. Speaking of shows, we got a few coming up. March 4th at the Bug Jar, Only Shallow, Agitated Earth, and a couple other bands. Leaking Head's got something coming up at the Chaos Compound in March. Integrity's playing at Photo City towards the end of the month. So just keep your eye out for flyers. Plenty more shows coming, I'm sure. I got the Patreon going on. Thanks to everybody who supported it so far. I'm going to be doing some live episodes this summer, hopefully, and looking to get some video equipment and whatnot to do that with. So thanks again to all the supporters. We'll have some early incentives coming soon for everybody with that. So this is episode 64. This is going to be a kind of fun for me because I'm going to be talking about a lot of stuff that kind of involves my early years, and we'll get to that, I'm sure. But yeah, we're going to be talking about with Joe from Hilka and Carbon Records and a bunch of other fun stuff that he's had going on over the years. So with all that being said, how you doing tonight, Joe?
Good. How you doing?
Pretty good. Yeah, like I said, I got kind of excited doing this because I started thinking back to like 95, 96 when I got really into like local music and you had a heavy hand in all that. So I'll be interested to see what your memory is of a young Josh Lyons tonight, I guess.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. I think you were probably about my son's age right now. I think you were like 15 when I met you.
Yep.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. What I was thinking about is, I don't know if you remember this, but I feel like I wrote you guys a letter because Bob Barker was playing at McCoy Jesuit High School for like a battle of the bands. Yeah, and didn't you guys all end up coming out and checking us out? And most of the Thunder Gods were there that night too, I want to say.
We did. Yeah, I was talking to someone not that long ago and they mentioned the battle of the bands at McQuaid. I'm like, oh shit, we went to that. And I remember like the three of us went and, you know, the teachers, whoever was chaperoning it, was like, why are there like older but not parents showing up to this thing? You know, like they knew we weren't students, you know, like, because we were all, you know, probably mid-20s at that point. Yeah, but I remember showing up to that thing. Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, it's got to be weird to, I can't imagine too many local kids write letters to people from other local bands to say, come check out my band at a battle of bands. Like my friend Ben and I, who played in that band, we talk about it all the time now. We have kids. We're like, man, what a weird thing to do, to like write these guys a letter and say, come check out our band. I mean, it's a different era too, obviously, with writing letters and stuff, you know?
Right. Yeah. Did you write it to like Suck, maybe? Like the zine we were doing?
I probably did. Suck. Was it Suck Fanzine or Suck Magazine?
Yeah, just Suck Scene or whatever.
Yeah. But yeah, yeah. That's probably is where I wrote it, because you guys all had that spot on Oxford Street or whatever. Sent you that letter. And yeah, we played that battle of bands. And then, yeah, so we'll get to that, because that was around the era of like Hilka and stuff. And there's another show that ties into like my early local memories that we'll talk about for that too. But before I guess we talk about all your bands and stuff, I'm curious about the upbringing question too, because I've never really like asked you about that. So kind of tell everybody about like your upbringing.
Yeah, I grew up in Scranton, PA. You know, got a couple sisters and a brother. Pretty boring. You know, I don't know. I wasn't really into music at all. All my siblings are older than me. My brother and I shared a room, and so he was like 7 years older than me. So I kind of just listened to music that he brought in, you know, like whatever, classic rock and stuff like that. And then he started working at a record store at the mall when I was probably in middle school. Well, when did Ride the Lightning come out by Metallica?
I'm not a huge Metallica fan, but I want to say maybe 84. We can look that up while you're talking.
Right. So I would have been like, I would have been just in high school, because I remember he used to bring home flats. I don't know if you know what flats are. They're like, they're the record covers, but they're just the cover part of it. And they're for promotional use at record stores. And so he used to bring home stacks of those things that they didn't, either extras or ones they weren't putting up at the store. And so we start lining our room with the ones that were cool, at least cool looking, you know? And I remember like Ride the Lightning was one of the cool ones. I never really listened to Metallica back then, but I remember that was one. Sabotage is horrible. I don't even know what they were called, a rock band, I guess. They always had goofy covers, you know, Marillion, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, so I listened to music of his, and then once I got into high school, I kind of started listening to, you know, just picking up stuff from MTV. I got into NXS really big in middle school or in high school. And then as part of my high school job, I worked at a department store. The head of the department store was huge into music. And the one day we got along really well. He was the general manager. He's probably like 10 years older than me or something. We were cleaning out a warehouse the one day. He was helping me and he was playing a mixtape. And every song that came on this tape, I was like, what the hell is this? Like, it blew my mind. And it was like the Butthole Surfers and the Pixies and Soul Asylum and some kind of other bands that never really made it bigger, Sonic Youth and stuff like that. So he started feeding me music. And that's when I kind of started getting into kind of underground stuff, because there was no like radio stations in town that did that. So I would like listen to music he gave me and then start watching, like, you know, late night MTV, 120 minutes on Sunday nights. Then I came to Rochester in 88 for school, for RET, and then started getting exposed to like the college radio here, and then meeting people, like meeting Nuge and stuff like that. I met Nuge. So he was like a year behind me. He's a year younger. So I met him, I think my sophomore year, maybe my junior year. And he got me into like all the Chicago kind of loud rock stuff, like Jesus Lizard and Tar, you know, bands like that, Killdozer, at the time Big Black, and then Shellac. But yeah, so that whole like Midwest scene, and then like math rock, his older brother was in Pittsburgh at the time. So he started kind of feeding us bands from Pittsburgh. So we started learning about, you know, Don Cab and Hurl and all the kind of math rock scene that was going on in Pittsburgh. But that, yeah, that was like, so he got me into Midwest stuff. And then we really got into like the Pittsburgh stuff, I guess late college or right after college. So like 92, 93, 94.
And is that around the time Hilka formed or?
Yeah, I was in a band in college. I started a band in 91. With my buddy Chris and our friend Bobby. She played drums and Chris played guitar. I didn't know how to play anything. I just kind of reached out. I wanted to learn how to play something. So I had my brother's crappy bass. We just started writing songs, and we were kind of like a grungy, noisy rock band. So we did that for a while. I became friends with Nuge. Nuge helped us record like the second cassette we did. We recorded it in like, where the hell was it? We recorded most of our records in like photo studios at RIT somehow. And I remember me and Nuge like recording overdub vocals, and he helped do some vocals on the second tape, and we mixed it all in like the photo lab. Cause he had access to like, it was either a 4-track or an 8-track. It was reel to reel. So yeah, we were doing that. Our friend Bobby graduated, moved away. Our buddy Joe joined the band on drums. We kept going for a while. And then in 93, we graduated. And so right after that, Nuge, me, Alex, who was also in Hilka, and our buddy Finkbeiner all moved in downtown to Oxford, the house that you were familiar with. And that's when we started Hilka. So Alex used to like hang out playing my bass, just like fucking around on my guitar when we lived at RIT. And we knew, do you know Diami and Idan and all those guys from like Tour Book?
I know the band, yeah.
Yeah, they were, were they in Tour Book? Matt Darby was in Tour Book. I just forget. So these are all like, when we were at RIT, I would host band parties at my apartment, and I would have Foundation play there all the time because I was friends with those guys. So Foundation would play and Standard Deviation would play, because I met the guy, Pat Wara, who was Standard Deviation. I met him online. He was an older guy, and they were kind of like a punk hardcore band, kind of, well, like Ramones type, you know, punk stuff. Pat was in Hunger Artist. So he was like one of the early guitar players in Hunger Artist. Standard Deviation is a Hunger Artist song. That's why he named the band that. Plus, he's a science nerd. Us. So yeah, so I used to do shows with Foundation and Standard Deviation at RIT. So we got to know like a bunch of the hardcore kids and like skater kids on campus. So when we graduated, Diami and those guys were still, they were younger, so they were still at RIT. They're like, you want to play a show at our apartment? And Field Fresh, our college band, was done, but me and Nuge were kind of thinking about starting a new band. So we're like, yeah, we'll play. We weren't a band yet. So one afternoon we told Alex, we're like, hey dude, we're starting a band and we got a show tonight. Let's go write some songs downstairs. So we went in the basement, wrote, Nuge and I were kind of working on some stuff, and we wrote like, I don't know, six or eight songs, got yelled at by the girls who lived in the other half of the house, and then played a show that night. And that was the first Hilka show. It was like the day before Halloween, I think, in 90, I want to say the fall of 93.
I want to, I got a couple of questions, but I want to circle back to something first, because you just kind of blew my mind by something you casually slipped into the conversation.
Right.
Did you say you met somebody online at some point during all this?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, back then, like, so the web wasn't around, but the internet was around. And I don't know if you know the difference between those things, but so there was like email, there was no websites, there was email, and there was like Usenet groups, which were like chat rooms sort of. But the big thing that we all used were mailing lists, email lists. And that's how, like, I was on a bunch of music mailing lists that friends of mine ran, one guy in Buffalo and another guy in Ithaca. And that's how I met Pat. So Pat Wara was on one of those. And so we realized we were both in Rochester, and he's like, oh, I just started a band. I didn't know about Hunger Artist. I think I probably saw a flyer around town, but I never like got downtown early on because I didn't have a car. So yeah, so we met a lot of people online through that mailing list. It was called the first one was called Grunge L. They always had dash L for list server. Grunge L was my buddy John in Buffalo ran it. And then my buddy Rob started one called Chug Changa. And they were both just music based. You know, they had rules, like you couldn't go off topic because you'd get like a lot of email during the day. A lot at that point was like five. Like, not like today where, you know, I'm inundated.
Yeah, that's crazy. I've never heard of anything like that. It almost sounds like a prehistoric Reddit or something. You know what I mean? Like, where it's just like.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, Usenet groups are basically what Reddit is modeled after. The list servers are just email lists, basically. So, I would send a note to the email list, and then everyone on the list would get it, you know? And, you know, for the most part, everyone starts to know each other too. So, you know, going forward just a little bit, me and my buddy Rob in Ithaca did a road trip in like 94, and we went and hung out and crashed at tons of people's places that we just knew from this mailing list. And we asked them like places to go, record stores to hit, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy. I've never heard anything like that. So I guess getting back to Hilka though, like you said, you would just kind of learn how to play the bass when you were in college. Like, I know you played drums in Hilka. Like, when did you start learning how to do that?
So in college, when I grabbed my bass, that's what I played in the college band, and our drummer. So we had, you know, two different drummers over the time, but they never like hung out with us on weekends. They had like other friends and other crews and stuff. So I bought like this really shitty drum set to have at my place to just jam when we were just like sitting around jamming. So I bought, it was like my first co-op job. I bought a drum kit for like, I don't know, $150 and like a hi-hat set. I couldn't afford any other cymbals. So I had a hi-hat and I had drums, no other cymbals. So then you try, you know, if you ever play a drum set, it's really weird to play without cymbals.
Yeah.
You come around and you hit your hi-hat again. So I just started like picking it up just from jamming on weekends and stuff like that. And so then when we finished and we started Hilka, that's when I decided I wanted to play drums full time. And Nuge at first played an organ. He didn't play guitar. We found an organ in the trash when we were moving out of RET. We dug it out of the trash, and that's what he played. So Hilka, for the first couple shows, were organ, drums, and bass.
But there was actual songs, like with those, like where he played old parts on the organ?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. I mean, they were just hilarious, really hilariously crude, heavy songs. You know, at the time we were like really into... we were kind of getting the like Zenny Giva, you know, Zenny Giva.
No, there's probably a lot of stuff that's going to come up in this conversation. Yeah. I'm not familiar with.
So like super heavy Japanese, kind of noise rock.
Okay.
Like KK Null is the leader of that band. He's done a lot of stuff in the whole Japanese, like noise and psychedelic scenes and stuff. But we were kind of into like, Zenny Giva and Unsane, which were a New York band, like loud rock band, and then the Chicago scene and, you know, math rock, but none of us could even remotely play anything complicated. So it was all very like straightforward, but heavy and dumb.
Yeah. And that's one thing that will come up in conversation, I think, with this is it's like the noise stuff that you're into. So I think you're kind of saying it there. Is that kind of when you started getting more into that kind of stuff too? Was like around this time?
Yeah, kind of. Nuge turned me on to a lot of the Japanese noise scene. He was getting like tons of CDs from Alchemy, and which was a store and mail order in Japan run by the Jojo Hiroshugi. I think that's how you say his last name. He was in a Japanese band called Hydrokaden. They're like one of the first Japanese noise groups. And we're going to circle back to the JoJo in a little bit. But so he was running this store, and like Nuge was just getting just tons of this weird noise stuff, like Japanese noise. I mean, brutal noise, you know. So he kind of turned me on to that. He was starting to kind of do that stuff. Like Sheet started when we were all living together on Oxford. I don't know if you've ever seen Sheet, his project.
I'm familiar with it. I feel like you had like a
metal,
like a silver and like CD that you spray painted silver. We put out as one of the carbon.
Yeah. He actually spray painted that in his, after we moved, I moved in with my girlfriend. He moved in with an apartment with Finkbeiner, and he spray painted all those in the fucking hallway and got spray paint all over the hardwood floors and stuff. It's classic Nuge. Right. But yeah, so like we started kind of getting into weirder, noisier stuff when we were all in Hilka. So probably like, so we started at Hilka in 93, probably like 94, I start the label. And that's when I was listening to like weirder experimental stuff. I was getting into like weird minimalist and I don't know, droney stuff, you know? So it sort of all started about that same time. So we had like the Hilka side of things, and then I would do like solo kind of noisier stuff. Nuge started doing Sheet. Alex had a side thing for a little bit, but he basically was just Hilka stuff.
Yeah. So then I think the first 7-inch that I got from you guys, it had like Think 511 was one of the songs and maybe like two other songs on it. Was that like the first 7-inch? I want to say it was a 3-song 7-inch with like a dark cover.
Yeah, that's the second one.
That's the second one?
The first 7-inch is called The Pipe. It's got a face of a dude, like an old guy on the cover, and he's got one of those like, I don't know, kind of like a hunting hat, like a snap up sort of European hat. So The Pipe, I think we always try to fit as much songs as we could on it. I think that was 3 songs as well. The Pipe was definitely the A side. And that came out, that wasn't actually the first two singles weren't on Carbon, because I didn't have Carbon really running at that point. Plus the band was like paying for it, so I felt weird like slapping my label name on it. But we all paid for that, and then the second one was Think 511, I think, was on that. That was, what else was on? Yeah, it was a black cover. I don't know if you know what the cover was. It was an S&M photo.
I probably wouldn't have known back then. I was pretty young when I got it.
Yeah, you had to unfold it to really see it because the front was very obscure. And then if you got a good copy, the vinyl sleeve had Hilka silk screened in silver on the plastic, which was a pain in the ass for Alex to do, but Alex pulled that off because he was a silk screener. Yeah, we did those two. We did 3 7-inches total. The Pipe, the second one, Science Scripture Salvation, maybe? I forget what it was called. No, Nesta Saws. And then the third one was, I can't remember. You can go on Discogs.
Yeah, and that's and again, going back to my early memories, there's like a compilation LP that came out, and there was a release show for that, and that was like the first local show that my friends and I went to, and that was like a stacked lineup of like Rochester bands at the time. You know what I'm talking about? That Freakazoid like matinee show.
Yeah. So Filardo has been posting. He posted a bunch of videos from that show.
Yep.
Outdoor. It was during the day. Yeah. That was the that was the Rochester what the hell is it called? Rocking from I forget what the comp was called.
On the Verge of Breaking Even.
That's what it is. And so the first 7-inch was on Trash Can. So I don't know if you know much about Trash Can Records, but I'm pretty sure it was Derek Duke Galaxy who started it. He basically was a name that we all would put on our records to make it look like we were all kind of part of a label. But like every band did all the work for each record. And then the comp, the same thing. We all chipped in to get the comp pressed and stuff. Yeah, I think, and I think we all had two songs on that, maybe.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to say Rob told me what you just told me before about how everybody put all the bands would put the Trash Can on there before, but yeah, I just want to read the lineup real quick from the show because this is a lineup from the, I think it's all the bands on the comp too. The Quitters, Mueller, Hilka, the Thunder Gods, Nod, Shop Class Squares, and Duke Galaxy and the Pipeliners. I want to say that's all the bands that are on that comp too. And all those bands played that day too. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure everyone played. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like our first
Rob
show.
Has videos. Rob has videos of probably half of that right now up online.
Yeah. He's been posting a lot of that. I have a blog attached to the website with this. Maybe I'll try to hit him up and see if he's cool. We posted a couple of the YouTube links on there or whatever. So people can find him that way or whatever. Cause he's got a lot of old videos he's been posting that have been pretty cool too, obviously.
Yeah, so. I didn't see, I'm assuming he has video from everybody. He didn't post Hilka yet. He's got another Hilka show up there, but not that one. I'd be curious to see that because that was really early on.
Yeah.
So I had a hard time playing and keeping up for a set.
Did you guys do because I know there was a lot of kind of bar, venues and stuff around town back then. Would you guys play pretty much all of them? Like Friends and Players and Bug Jar, obviously. And
you know, the Bug Jar wasn't doing shows yet at that point. The Bug Jar was only kind of a dance place. Like they didn't do music shows, band shows for a while. I don't really remember exactly what year they started, but and even then they were open. I want to say they were open Tuesday to Saturday. And when they first started doing bands, there was only certain nights they would do bands. They would never do bands on Fridays for the longest time because they made their money because it was a big DJ night. Which I get, it was a pain for me trying to book a show with someone we knew coming to town, but I understood, and especially now I really understood that's how they made their money, on a Friday night. But we were we played Friends of Players God all the time. Because it was so you just booked and you just showed up and played. No one handled anything there. There was Freakazoid and Carpe Diem, not Carpe Diem. What was Freakazoid? Is that the place that's still around?
It's called, it's where it's they after Vertex burned down and moved into there. Now it's called,
oh, that's what it, yeah. So Vertex and Freakazoid were, yeah, because Vertex was somewhere else, I think,
on Liberty Pole, around the corner.
And then we played Bosco's, which was X. I mean, we probably played while it was called X on Liberty Pole, and then it was Bosco's at one point. So we opened up for I'm trying to think. I get the shows mixed up between my college band, which was called Fields Fresh, and then Hilka. Because we opened a couple shows over there. That was the main places that we would play, I think. Oh, The Abyss, too, which was, I don't know what street. It's right near the on-ramp to when you're going down South Ave and you're getting on to the 490. It's a little street to the left. It's a little dead end street.
Yeah.
And that was a place we played a handful. That was one of our first bar shows, I think, was there. It was downstairs. Yeah, they did shows downstairs. And then they eventually, started doing shows upstairs. But it was a total dive of a place. It was hilarious. It was like Friends of Players, but bigger. Just hilarious dive.
Yeah. I remember when Bob Barker was first coming around and we were talking to a few people up playing Friends and Players. Somebody told me, it was just pay your dues, man, play Friends and Players, and we played, did you guys play that with us? I know we played with Vision Stain there. I can't remember if Hilka, I feel like there was three bands that night, but I know we played a show there with Vision Stain in 96, maybe.
We might have.
Yeah, because I feel like you guys might, I know Nuge was there, but I can't remember if you guys were playing or not. I don't have that flyer anymore. I made shitty flyers. So I would hand write the flyers and just write in my really poor penmanship, which I'm surprised you guys even found the information of the show if I wrote you the letter about it for that show or whatever. But I know we played one show with you guys on St. Paul at above Club Z. It was my girlfriend at the time's birthday party / show, and it was a bunch of local punk bands and you guys, and there might have been one other, maybe the Thunder Gods played, but I don't remember. But I know you guys played.
I think Moment of Truth played that.
They might have too. Yeah.
I remember we shared a show with them once, and I didn't know who they. I kind of knew the drummer, Jim. Yeah, I would see Jim around. I don't know. Somehow we would run into each other, probably at Record Time or something. And that was the only person I knew in the band. But I think Andy Gilmore was in the band at that time, but I didn't know him. And years later, we became good friends. But I'm trying to think what, yeah, I saw a couple of good shows up there. Hilke played there another time too with our buddies Lyft. We're like Eastman kids that we did the split. We did that CD together with them. Yeah, that was a neat space.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's a really cool, like,
big windows space. And stuff. Yeah, yeah.
You could see it. Like, those are really cool apartments now. They're really, I think they're probably expensive now or whatever, but
I bet. Yeah.
Like, you know, but yeah, what were some of the, did you have any like standout shows in your memory from like those, that era or whatever?
Oh, dude, you know, we played a show at Friends and Players. So I was dating this girl, Karen, we dated for like a summer or something. And then she started dating this guy, Mike Westfall, who we're good friends with. And they would come to all our shows, every show they would be there. And we played a Friends and Players show. It was a horrible blizzard. And we're like, fuck it, we're still gonna play. Like, and they were the only ones who showed up. And then there was the regulars at the bar just getting loaded like normal. Karen and Mike were there and we played our usual, like our set was usually about a half hour. And then we would play one song that went on for any length of time. And it was very much modeled after the like Zenigi, the heavy repetitive Japanese noise rock stuff. And we played the song for like another 40 minutes. And they just stood there, like watched us the whole time. And we there was another show there that at one point Nuge still had the organ, but was playing guitar as well. And the organ, he would like reach in the back and start doing kind of circuit bending with his fingers. He would just start shorting the shit out with his fingers. And like each key had a tuning knob on the back, which is kind of rare for cheap organs like that. But he was doing that. And I'm like just playing. I'm trying not to puke because I had a hard time keeping up with anything. And I'm playing, and all of a sudden I see this flash of light above me, and I look up, and there's smoke coming from the back of the organ. And dude just like startled because he got shocked. I forget what show it was, but there was a handful of people in the crowd like, what the hell just happened? And that was the end of the organ era of Hilke, because we could never find, it was called a Magnus. Magnus, that was the brand. The ones you always found were, you know, the air organs, they have like air going through them.
Yeah.
And this wasn't one of those. This was like actual electronics and you never found them anywhere. You would only find the crappy air ones, which didn't do what we needed to do. So yeah, the end of the organ era.
The fun was over.
Yeah. Those were probably my favorite. And like, I still remember those shows. And then we played the big battle of the bands at Horizontal Boogie Bar, Water Street, whatever it was called at the time. And that's one that Rob has the video posted of where we played. It was like six bands, I think, total, six or eight bands. Got picked to do a battle of the bands, and we played that. And that was a blast.
Yeah. Now, how did you guys like get like any sort of like connections like that? And as we're going to get to, like, there's the Fugazi show too. Like, did you have like, did you like spread the records out like around town and stuff? Or did you just like know people from playing venues or?
That Fugazi thing was a total mistake. Or I mean, not a mistake. It was Transmission 56 were around. I don't know if you remember them. They were like another math rock band at the time.
Yeah.
You know, whenever that was, like mid to late 80s or 90s. Either they were supposed to already play or there was some other band, local band that was on the bill and they couldn't make it. I think that's what it was. So whoever it was contacted Trans and asked them to open, and Trans like, we can't, because I think one of their guys is out of town. They're like, you should get Hilke to do it. Because there wasn't like there was no other like math rock or indie rock bands. Like most of the bands in town were like garagey or metal. You know, or like more of the pop, like the Quitters and stuff like that, garage pop type stuff. So yeah, they called us the Saturday afternoon and we're like, yeah. So we showed up and got completely ignored by the Fugazi guys. but that was the show with Blonde Redhead played too. Yeah. And that was, yeah, I just probably just heard of that band at the time. They were fun to watch. Yeah.
Yeah, I like them live. I can't say, I dated a girl a couple years later who had one of their CDs, so I'm sure I heard it through her. You know, I liked them though. They're cool live. But it was cool. I mean, I love Fugazi, obviously. So
yeah.
I thought it was really cool you guys got to play with them. But did you guys ever get any other opportunities to open for like any like big bands like that or anything? Or
I don't think so. We played like we played an RET festival at one point, but that was like there was multiple stages, so it's not like we shared a stage with like Yola Tango played that one. I think that might have been the year that then Sonic Youth played Inside later on and Nod opened up for them, because they had like they knew about Nod, and that was right around the time that Steve Shelley, the drummer from Sonic Youth, was putting out Nod Records.
Yeah,
on label. Yeah, no, not really. You know, we ended up going to Toronto. We won that Battle of the Bands, and that got us like admission into this music conference up in Toronto. So we played a show up there to like no one at, I don't know, 6:30 in the evening. We were like the first band out of like 10 bands. We had to load in at like 3. I don't know if you've ever played like a big city, but it's weird. Like they have you load in early in the afternoon, they lock your stuff away. You might sound check in the afternoon and then you come back. Right. So we had a load in, sound check. We play a show at like 6:30. We can't take our stuff. It's got to get locked up there until the end of the night when everyone unloads. We don't want to see any of the bands we're playing on the bill with, because they were like just they were like biker bands. But we knew of other really good bands playing this conference. So we're like, well, we're going to leave. Can we leave? And they're like, yeah, you can leave. Just come back at whatever, 2. So then we went and checked out, you know, there was other bands that we really dug that just happened to be playing the conference. So we did that and then went back to gather up our equipment at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m.
Now, I noticed when I was digging through like Carbon and stuff, it's, it looks like you had done some of the Hilco in like 2014. Like, is the band still active or?
No. What was that? That was 2014, really?
Was that like sometimes on Bandcamp it posts dates, like it might be when you uploaded it too. So that might be like the release
date. That was probably just when I uploaded it. Yeah.
That's like older stuff.
I was finally getting that stuff up there. Yeah, we did I have Discogs up so I can remember. We did the 3 7 inches, 94, 95, 96, and then in 95, we did the CD split with Lyft. And then 99, we did a CD. In 2000, we did a CD. And then in like 2005 or 6, we were recording another CD. We had it all recorded. We didn't have like overdubs done. And that's when Alex was like, I'm done. He's like, I'm retiring. That's how he put it. I'm retiring. And we're like, all right. So we have I just in fact started listening to those recordings again, because every couple of years I plan on finishing them in some way, which may or may not happen. Who knows? But yeah, so we have like a release kind of not in the can, but almost. And then we kind of stopped. And Alex kind of stopped. He was playing in another band too called the Shackletons with Derek Duke Galaxy. That was like a... I guess they were garage rock sort of. But yeah, he just kind of stopped playing. He was like, I'm bored. I don't really like playing anymore. So that's when Nuge and I started Turd. So that was in 2007, I want to say, we started that band. And that was just Nuge went to bass and it was just bass and drums.
Yeah. I mean, you've done like a bunch of different like noise and like projects and stuff otherwise that we didn't really discuss talking about in the interview too, right? Or
Yeah, I mean, I've always been doing my solo thing.
Yeah.
And then I had Speed Queen / SQ, which was my buddy Mark, who was in Lyft. He was an Eastman kid. So we did a duo, like kind of experimental. It would get kind of rock at times. I was in a pop band with two girls called Flywheel. They were like, we were like indie pop band, kind of like Unrest. And that was the same time I was in Hilca. So yeah, for a while there, I was in 3 bands that were pretty consistently playing. I was practicing 6 nights a week, which was not fun because my ears are ringing kind of all the time. And Flywheel practiced like 3 times a week for like hours each time. It was kind of intense.
Wow.
and then Hilke would practice like 2 nights a week, and then Speakman would get together usually once a week. Yeah, so that was a busy time. But I did different things in each band too. So it was like, it was fun in that way, you know. I played bass and Flywheel and Speed Queen. I played whatever we were doing, and then Hilke drums. So
did you guys ever play like an official last show for Hilco or anything, or did you guys just kind of like,
dude, I don't remember. I remember, like, I have a video of we did a 10-year show. I do remember doing that, and we had we did like, there was three sets. I remember we did three sets. It was one set of like old stuff, one set of current stuff, and then one set of our friends covering us. So we had like a bunch of different people, like from Mueller and stuff like that, cover Hilke songs, and that was kind of fun.
And one thing that I think will kind of segue into talking about Pengo too, that I told you before that I kind of want to talk to you about, is the band Fat Day. I know they had played here once before, and then somehow my friend Ben and I, who played in Bob Barker with me, we got a hold of them, and we ended up booking them with you guys and probably a couple hardcore bands in 98. Yeah. And then I booked them again in 2000 with Pengo. And then in 2002, Hilke played too. So I realized when I was putting the interview together tonight that I booked you, like, you're probably the only person that played pretty much every show with Fat Day that we booked. You know what I mean? So
I feel like Hilke played every show.
Hilke might have played the one in 2000 too. I know Pengo played, because I remember John was sitting there reading like a fucking car magazine or something in a chair.
Hilke played that one too. So I played two sets that night. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I remember playing that show in Pengo. That was when I was still on guitar in Pengo. It was because it was early on in Pengo. And I played like Derek Bailey noise guitar, like just twink, crunk, crunk, crunk. And yeah, John was reading something probably to try to make everyone uncomfortable or something.
I think his mission was accomplished. So I remember at least one or two people coming to me afterwards and being like, what was that? You know?
But Hilke played, we played the church over on Blossom, I think, once. And we played a VF, the Pengo one was down at the VFW, I think, down at Henrietta.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we played one other show.
That other one was at the Bug Jar, because I think I booked like a double header with Fat Day. Sometimes I would book at the Bug Jar, like a matinee show during the day, and then like a 21 over show at night. And I think you guys played the night show. I don't have that flyer for some reason. I was looking for it today, but I couldn't find it.
Oh, no, that was the band after Fat Day. What was the band they had after Fat Day?
I can't remember. I was trying. I looked them up recently too, so I feel kind of like I should have looked more into them for this interview too. But
I think there was a show at the Bug Jar that they played. You know, because they always had like every time they came to town, they had some other thing they were doing, like those trampoline things that they had with the lights and the helmets. Yeah. And there was a Bug Jar show once where they did like, it was kind of a rock opera about fairies and the brown demon or something. And the brown demon was like this big ball that they covered in like brown duct tape, and they asked for volunteers in the audience to be fairies. So they're like, Nudes, Joe, you guys. So we put on these costumes, these fairy costumes, like tutus and stuff, and we had to attack the brown demon or whatever, or gargoyle or something. And we went fucking nuts on it. Like, it was the first time I ever did any costume type stuff, which I've have done a lot since then. But it was hilarious. We sort of like really got into it. And I don't know how we didn't really get hurt, because we were going nuts bouncing on this. This thing wouldn't pop. So we were like doing full like jumps and body slams onto this big ball. Like, it was a big ball. It was, you know, a couple of feet in diameter. And we were like bouncing off it and landing on our backs and stuff. And they were playing, you know, some rock opera song that went along with the battle, the great battle.
Now, I know you've come across some quirky stuff over the years, but those guys have got to be like towards the top of the list for like out, like originality and just like the kind of stuff they do.
Where, I mean, you know, especially like that, were the helmets and the trampolines one show?
The helmets, I think, were the one where that Pengo played. I'm not positive though. I know that, no, you might be right though. The trampolines were definitely the first show.
It was
I think the helmets were separate, but I'm not.
Yeah.
I hope somebody videotaped all those shows, because like we've been trying to find old videotapes lately. And that's something I hadn't thought of until just like talking to you right now. I would love to see like videos of those performances, because that was just, you know.
Yeah. I mean, like from a, you know, they were just a kind of punk sort of sounding band, you know.
Yeah.
But what they did, and then they created these songs out of kind of electronic type stuff, you know, with the triggered trampoline and the light sensors on the helmets. Yeah. And then they would look at each other and play different melodies by like triggering the helmets with their lights on each. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, at the time, up until that point, I didn't see anything like that. I mean, since then I've seen a shitload of weirdo noise dudes doing all sorts of dumb shit, you know. But at the time, that was, you know, and for a normal, quote, a normal band, like, it was nuts. No one was doing that.
Yeah, but you're definitely right. It's definitely one of those bands where if you were just to, like, pass along a 7-inch, they'd be like, eh, you know. But if you, once you see them live, you're like, okay, right. You know. Right.
Yeah.
So, like I was saying when I was putting together the notes for Pango, I don't even really know where to begin. I have so many questions, like how you guys would, like, the, what the process would be to put together live shows, like, to, like, put out albums, you know what I mean? Like how did it all begin? And
yeah. So Pango started in, 98, I think. I remember exactly where it was. Me and John and Finkbeiner were standing in front of the taps at the Bug Jar. And we talked about, one of us talked about doing a band together, like a no wave band. Do you know what no wave is?
I'm more familiar because of, like, I looked it up after you guys, like, you know what I mean? You guys are the first ones I've ever really heard of like doing that kind of stuff, though, obviously.
Yeah. So, like, this was a movement in mainly New York City, kind of during and at the tail end of punk, where it was like dudes. I mean, theoretically, I don't know exactly what they were going for. In my mind, it was really a rejection of, like, what punk became, which was, you know, kind of bullshit and normal, right? And it got like commercialized and stuff, right? So it was guys who were really deconstructing rock or music in general. So there's a bunch of bands, you know, in New York City that James Chance and the Contortions and Art of Lindsay and Mars and all these bands, you know, and like Sonic Youth is coming up at that same time and Swans are coming up at that same time, kind of with that, all that shit. And Glenn Branco's guitar guy. So there was a resurgence in the 90s of kind of no wave. So all these like Chicago bands started doing what they called now wave, but it was like that. It was like a no wave kind of resurgence. And so, and John, of course, knew, John and Jason both know a ton about music and stuff. So they knew about the original shit. And they're like, yeah, let's do a no wave thing. I'm like, yeah, I'm down with that. So Jason played drums and he can't play drums. I play guitar and I barely could play guitar at the time. I still can't play guitar. And then John was going to play trombone. So it's trombone, guitar, and drums. And Jason played drums like a gorilla, like just hitting them as heavy as he can and exhausting himself in like 5 minutes. So we did a handful of shows that were that. It was just like really spastic, fast, short, you know. Every once in a while I would get like super slow and low and just drony sounding and then spazzy again. So we did like, I don't know, that for about a year or so, not a ton of shows. And then we booked, this guy reached out to me from Connecticut, from not New Haven, Storrs, Connecticut, which I think is where UConn is maybe. He reached out and he's like, hey, I want to book you guys. I got Jojo Hiroshugi coming to town. And I don't really know who this is at the time. And I probably mentioned it to John. He's like, holy fuck, that's the guy from Heijo Kaden, the Japanese guy I mentioned earlier, one of the premier early pioneers of Japanese noise. So he's like, yeah, we're fucking coming down to do that. So we set up a weekend playing there. And then we played like an abandoned building in Brooklyn, which is probably worth $300 million right now. It was totally in like the area of Brooklyn that's, you know, just outrageously expensive. Nuge came with us. And so right around that time, Nuge started kind of playing with Pango because he wasn't originally in it. And we switched things up where I started playing drums, sort of my normal instrument. Jason switched to guitar, which he is very good at. And John was doing some horn, but he was starting to play the floor bass, which is this thing that Nuge had. Kind of like a keyboard, but you play it with your feet, but he plays it with his hands. And then Nuge was doing like noise, blowing. He started doing his blowing stuff, which led into Asthmatic, you know, and like noise making pedals and shit like that. So we started doing that. So we started becoming more, I don't know what you would call it, like almost psych at times. Kraut at time, Kraut Rock, you know, if you know Kraut Rock much at all, but you know, like Can. When people ask me, like when normal people that I meet, like, you know, parents of my kids' friends and stuff, ask me like what Pengo sounds like, I just say like early Pink Floyd. We don't really sound like early Pink Floyd, but it's a close enough reference. If they know what early Pink Floyd sounds like, then they sort of have an idea of what we would sound like. So around that time, that's kind of when we switched from being no wave to being whatever you call us. I don't know. John always describes us in very weird terms. Avant, drone, noise, psych, hydra. There, how's that?
I was going to say, does the early Pink Floyd reference ever worry you about being referred to as like acid heads? But I guess what you just said there would probably make you feel like you might get the same. And I know none of you guys like fuck with like drugs or anything either. It's just a funny like thing or whatever. You know what I mean?
Right. So. Yeah. It's just, I mean, you know, when it comes to like people who I don't know what their musical background is, like what they're exposed to, that's the closest that I can get to where everyone knows what Pink Floyd sounds like. Not everyone knows what early Pink Floyd sounds like, right? Everyone usually goes, oh, like The Wall or Dark Side of the Moon. And I'm like, well, no, they had like, you know, a half dozen records before that. So I usually use that as a leading point. And then I might just get a nod and then that's fine. Or they might go, oh, like this. And they'll mention a record. And then you're like, oh, shit. Okay. You know, more than, you know, the average, you know, music fan.
Would there be like, so how would you guys like go like about like with like shows and stuff? Would you guys like plan like a concept or something, or just like, would there be like a prac, you know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it is all improv. So yeah, we talk about themes for shows. That's it. And sometimes not until like, I mean, we would sometimes get together and jam. Kind of like practice for the show, but not like working out anything for a show, just to kind of get loose and whatever, and hopefully work out bad ideas. And then usually John will be like, all right, let's start like this and do this. And it could be very esoteric terms, or it could be clear, like, let's start quiet and get loud. But sometimes it could be like, let's start like this and get, you know, do a moonlander, you know, it'll be like some term, you know, some phrase or concept that'll give us, and we all sort of interpret whatever the hell that means. We did a tour in 2001 with a whole bunch of friends in a Winnebago, and that was the Five Phenomena tour, is called, which is a concept that like our buddy Rat, some other guys came up with, which is 5-minute sets by 12 bands. So it's an hour long set, right? So there's no, it's 10 bands. So it's 5-minute set, 1-minute turnaround between bands. And then 10 bands, that gives you 60 minutes. So we did this tour. We were all in a Winnebago and we did like, 7 dates or something. And each show, John would introduce the band and track we were covering. And that's when we learned what we were doing. And a lot of times I was like, I don't even know what the hell that band is. Like, he would throw out some band. Sometimes it would be like, you know, I don't know, BTO, you know, like some like classic rock band. And we just, or I think we might've did like a Zeppelin song, but you know, of course we didn't do a Zeppelin song. So that was a concentrated version of kind of what Pengo sets are usually. They're usually like talking about some theme maybe, and that's about it. Yeah.
Would you ask John afterwards, like why he picked the songs or why he picked?
No, I don't. I mean, on the tour, I probably was like, who is that? but no, usually not. No. And after the shows, we like, there's usually not a whole lot of talking about the show. I mean, I think as we got older, we're like, oh, that went well, you know? early on, we were like, whatever, you know?
And I know, like I said, there's probably a lot of other projects we could discuss, but the other one I kind of want to ask you about before we jump into the label a little bit more is, I don't even know how to pronounce it, but you did that like noise kind of project at the Cobbs Hill during a blizzard recently. Like, is that something you do frequently, or is that your first time doing that?
Yeah, no. So that's a duo I've been doing for a number of years now called Tamol, which the word Tamol is the root for tumultuous. It's a Yiddish term. So my partner in crime in that is Cameron, who's Jewish. So like when we were coming up with a name, I started looking at like Yiddish terms to use. And I'm like, that's perfect. Like tumultuous. Like that's exactly what we wanted to do. So that that project started out as just kind of a noise duo. Somehow got into doing costumes, which I never thought I would do. Like I said, the Fat Day show, I was like, wow, that was kind of fun. You sort of lose yourself when you have a costume on. And then John and I did a show once where we pretended we were Cocky SP from they're from Minneapolis, and they were going on tour and they were supposed to play Rochester. And the one guy in a band broke his leg the night before they were leaving for tour. So they couldn't make their tour. So we had it booked at the Monty's Crown. And John was like, why don't we just, oh, the band asked, I think, everybody who books shows on the tour, like, play as us, like, fake it. And they always wore costumes and stuff, right? So, and they always had, like, they always had an ironing board with them for some reason as a noise-making device, you know, contact mic or whatever. John somehow found an ironing board, like, that afternoon on the street. And we brought in, we had masks on and we did a show. And after that show, I was like, wow, that's kind of fun. Like playing in a costume. You sort of, I don't know if you've ever done it, but you sort of lose yourself. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel like you're you. I don't know how to describe it. So when Cameron and I started Tumult, we did just sort of normal, you know, two noise dudes. And then I got the idea of making a helmet that had all my pedals on it. So I made that. It was heavy as hell. I almost suffocated in it. I fixed that. We did some things. Then we came up with this bunny, sort of the space bunny idea, which Cameron had that outfit on for the snow show. So it's just like we get tights and stuff them and we wear them overhead. And we usually wear like cleaning overalls. So we've done like a billion variations of those things. So with that one, a while ago, I talked about doing, I wanted to do a show in the cold, like outside in the cold. And so I'm like, let's watch the weather and see if there's a good snowstorm coming up. And earlier that week, sure enough, it was forecasted. So I'm like, let's do a show outside. And there's one this Friday, a storm, which I've been teetering on maybe asking him to do, but I don't know if we're going to do it. But it was a blast. So that was kind of related to the Joe Placent day tours that I've been doing for like 20 years now, which is me playing outside and for the last like umpteen years playing outside with other people too. So I find it's a lot of fun playing outside. You know, using that environment and not being in a normal bar and stuff like that. And the snow thing, I just thought was going to be a lot of fun and brutal. So
you don't ever get any blowback for like noise ordinance or any crap like that when you do like outdoor stuff?
No, you know, I mean, we're never really that loud. Like we don't have big amps, you know. I usually have battery powered like 10 watt amps. When I first started doing the day tour, so that was in when the hell did I start that? I don't know when I started. 2000, 2001. I thought for sure I was going to get someone harassing me. And the first or second show of the first day tour, I had a guy come up, walking up to me, and he had like one of those classic, you know, windbreaker jackets, like a coach would wear. I'm like, oh, it's a guy from like the county or something like that. And I play the show and he doesn't stop me, you know, and they were only like 50 minutes at each location. And I finish and he comes up to me and he's like, ah, kind of interesting. What are you recording with? And he was a recording like nerd. And he turned me on to like these crazy binaural microphones. Like he turned me on to all this like recording technology for outdoor field recording. So he was just a dude who just happened to pound me on, this was at a Lock 32 on a canal. And I was like, wow. And every year I always expect somebody to complain, but the closest we got was in front of Needle Drop a couple years ago. Essentially Turd played on the sidewalk, and our buddy Dennis lives at least a quarter mile down South Ave, and he's like, dude, I totally heard you down there. And like a couple neighbors across the street were complaining, but you know, Russ is like, dude, they're gonna be done in like 5 minutes. Like,
yeah, it's South Ave too. It's not like you're like Pittsburgh or something. You
know? Right, exactly. I have thought about doing. I live in Brighton. I had thought about doing a show at the gazebo right at 12 Corners.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I guess kind of jumping into the label. I mean, it's kind of fascinating to me. You've been running this thing for like 30 years now. You know, like it's
almost
It's pretty cool. Like, have you stayed consistent? I know for a while that it seemed like you were putting a ton of stuff out. Like, have you kind of like dialed back a little bit, or are you still doing a bunch of stuff? Or
there's never been consistency.
It seemed for a while there like you had a lot coming out though. Like,
it was I mean, in particular, the year of 2001, I did. So a couple of years before that, I started trying to do CDRs, right? So I'm a techie guy, and I saw these CDR writers coming out that were finally under $1,000. And so I bought one, and I bought a spindle of 100 blank CDs, and that was $600 when you first bought them. So it was like, fuck, this better work. And I put out something of mine and something of Jason Finkbeiner's. No one could play them. Like, all these players would have you'd get errors. You know, like early CDR technology was really fucking bleeding edge. So I was like, fuck it, I can't do that anymore. So I went back to doing CDs. So I did a bunch of CDs around that time. And then in 2001, leading up to that, I saw some noise labels doing CDRs again. I'm like, oh, maybe it's better. Like, maybe the players can play them better. So I started a CDR series, and that year I did 2 releases every month. It was insane. I was like, you know, just constantly, I was all pan packaged. Each package was like a different weird package design. And everyone was, I think, 100 copies. So yeah, that was a crazy kind of year. And then I kind of kept going with CDRs for a long time after that. But then in like 2008, CD sales just died. So that was like the beginning, the recession, and music sales in general just kind of died because everyone was like, they had no money to spend. And then CD sales kind of never came back until like now. So CDs are getting more popular again because of the vinyl issues, the pressing issues that are going on, you know, over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's really funny. The next guy that I'm interviewing after you is a huge CD fan. We always make fun of him.
Yeah,
For being into CDs, and he's I just feel like he's sitting there laughing now with his collection of CDs. It's probably going to skyrocket in value now.
I got a couple friends who have been calling, who have been predicting the CD revival for various reasons, whether it's maybe fake nostalgia of kids who didn't grow up with them, but now they're like, that's their physical media, and vinyl's too expensive for them. Or the, you know, it's just, it's a good format for a certain kind of music too, which, I mean, for me, I just stopped putting them out because no one was buying them. So I was like, I have to at least try to put out a format that people buy. So I went back to doing vinyl. It's just so expensive. And now it's like on top of the expense, it's like huge turnarounds. Like, I talked to my pressing plant the other day, the one I use, and now they're 12 to 14 months.
For each release?
Yeah, that's how long it takes for a turn. Like, some are shorter. So I have 3 releases at a pressing plant in Cleveland right now, and that one I'm getting way quicker than anywhere else because they were like, we happen to have time on our 180 gram press, so it's different presses for different weights. And like, 180 gram is not something I don't care about heavy vinyl, but I'm like, well, fuck, I can get that pressed in March as opposed to next November.
Yeah.
I might as well. So this is back in like November, I scheduled these. And the guy's like, yeah, if you want to dial, you can schedule it now and I'll get you on in March. I'm like, all right. So I got 3 releases coming out in March, or get pressed in March. They'll probably get released in April or May. But yeah, I talked to the other plan I use, and yeah, they gave me the year to 14 months.
Oh, that's crazy. I feel like the era we were talking about mainly in this interview so far, it was like a 3-month turnaround at most, like from recording to press. You know what
that
I mean?
That was sort of standard for almost all the formats. CDs were maybe a little quicker, but yeah, like 3 months, you know, 3 to 4 months. Vinyl, like a couple years ago, it bumped up to, when it started getting big again, But at least there were more pressing plants. It went to like 6 months, which is still, you know, it's kind of a pain at the time. I'm like, oh fuck, 6 months, you know, because you're putting out like, you know, you got to pay half up front. So then you're like, for 6 months, you're not making any money on that thing because you paid six, you know, half the amount up front. So the delay just sucks, you know, money wise. And I don't want to like sell pre-orders that far in advance, you know. I don't want to sell pre-orders until I know the damn thing's on the press. Because I don't want to be, I've been a consumer. I have records in my list of things I ordered like a year ago that still aren't pressed. And they were supposed to be pressed months ago, you know.
Usually this is the part of the conversation where people reference all the Adele records being pressed at all these pressing plants.
Oh, right, dude. Yeah. I mean, between Adele and like Taylor Swift. Yeah, but the Adele thing was like they pressed some ungodly amount, like a million records or something. And it jammed up all these plants. It's like, why do you don't need to press that many records? There's not that many Adele people who want to buy a record.
Yeah, that's really crazy.
You know, and she's good, but it's like, I'm sorry, not that many people want to buy it.
Yeah.
If they do, they're just gonna buy it and put it on a shelf, you know, like, oh, here's my one record. Look at that. I got a record up there. Not that, you know, I'm not ragging on people who buy a record. You know, I get the souvenir part of it. I'm obsessed with objects, but yeah, it just kind of stinks for, you know, any non-major label to try to get anything done.
So like how many, like how do you have releases coming up right now then? Like how many do you like consistently have like going on like for the last like couple of years, so to speak?
I don't know. You'd have to look at Discogs. you know, I actually did this work not that long ago, because a couple years ago I did my 25th anniversary. I did an art show at Rocco where I'm good friends with Blue, the director over there. And so I talked to him about it. He's like, oh yeah, I want to do this. So he gave me one of the small rooms and I mounted the cover art or objects on the entire wall. So I had like all the CDs in one section, all the vinyl in our section, all the cassettes in our section. And that's when I started looking at like how many records I put out per year. And it was definitely like slowdowns, like when I started having kids and just like super busy, like when I went from a normal full-time job to a freelance job where I had to really pay attention, like money and time, that's when things would slow down. And that was right around the kind of recession time too, like late 2000s. The last, let's see, I put out like three years ago now, I think I put out, you know, a handful of things all at the same time. The Wound double LP compilation. I put out the last Pingo LP, Ian Downey is Famous LP, Crush the Hunter, and Nod. And those were all within, they were for the 25th anniversary year. And now, yeah, that was intense. I ended up doing like a Kickstarter for that because it was so much money right off the bat to do all those at the same time. I needed to front load some of the money, but
that was all vinyl you did that year, all four of those?
Yeah, that was all vinyl. Five. Well, four and then the double LP. Yeah. Wow. And the double LP was like one, a double LP, and I pressed a lot of them because I had so many people on the comp. And I needed to give copies away, then I needed to have enough on hand to try to sell and make some money back, you know.
And that seems kind of like a good, like, I don't know what the word I'm looking for. It's but they've been consistent like around the same time, around the same length as the label, pretty much, this Carbon, if not a little bit longer even, right?
Nod is longer, yeah. Nod is still the longest running band in Rochester.
Wow.
They're still together, they're still cranking. Those guys are awesome.
That was my first record that I ever bought. I forget which one it was, but it was like a two-song 7-inch I got at Record Time.
Oh, it's, man, really?
94, 95. Yeah, it was. That's the one thing we haven't talked about. What's that? The picture on the cover, yeah.
Scrappy on the cover, and the other guys are jumping out of his mouth.
That's the one, yeah.
With the same cover, but yeah, that's their first 7-inch. Yeah.
Yeah, I had that, and then I think Rob was working there at the time, so I would just ask him about stuff. And they had like a box of like local stuff, I want to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Up there on the counter. Yeah,
yeah. I feel that's got to be where I got your the Hilke 7-inch. It's where I got like the first Fat Day 7-inch. Like there was a lot of treasures purchased there. But yeah, no, like you're saying, it's just cool to see those guys still kicking around after so many years. Like I honestly didn't realize they were still a band until I started prepping for this interview and saw you've done that record.
Yeah, we've shared a practice space with them, a number of different practices with them for the last probably 15 years. Because they're great guys and, you know, not pains to share a practice space with. And yeah, so I've done, I did a split LP with them and Attica Basement a number of years ago. And then we did the full length a couple of years ago. Yeah.
And now I guess one thing we haven't really talked about is like with like COVID and pandemic and stuff, like have you kind of like, did you like when did you feel comfortable like playing live and stuff again at that, like after everything started opening up again?
You know, like last summer when, you know, vaccinations happened and like the rates went wicked down, that's when I got comfortable. So Cameron was running the Psychic Garden, which is the space that he's got. And so Pengo played a show there. That was kind of late. That was at the end of the summer, early fall. And I think I went to a couple jazz shows at the Bop Shop that summer, but like clubs weren't booking quite yet, I don't think, last summer. And I wasn't like quite comfortable going into a smaller club. So yeah, Pengo played the show at Psych Garden with Tetsuo Nakatani, amazing Japanese American percussionist. And then I did the day tours every year because that's outside and, you know, we were able to keep distance and stuff too. So that was kind of fun. And I remember like the 2020 day tour, you know, a lot of people I know come to those. I know most of the people who come to it, but yeah, there's always new people too. But a couple friends who came to it, they're like, this was like, they needed it, you know, cause like we all go to shows a lot and like, we didn't go to shows for a long time. So it was just kind of cool to like be around people we're normally around and see some, you know, weirdo noise and stuff. But yeah, it's just recently, like I still haven't been to the Bug Jar since before the pandemic started. I've been to the Bop Shop for a couple jazz shows just recently. That's it, I think. Oh, I went to the Chaos Compound, which I was a little nervous about.
Yeah.
Our buddy Rat Bastard from Miami came up to play. So I really had to see that because I haven't seen him in a long time. He's great to hang out with. And then a very good friend of his who we knew and played shows with passed away like days before that. So we wanted to go see him and hang out and stuff like that. That was a cool space, you know, dirgy.
Yeah, I haven't been there yet. I've heard, like, I've seen videos. It looks really cool. So
yeah, it's something else.
Yeah. Like I mentioned in the intro of the episode, that there's a local band, Leaking Head, that I'm really like, a new local hardcore punk band. They've been around for like a year or so.
Yeah.
They're playing there with a bunch of bands, so I might check that out. But I've been to a few shows, but like when I go to, like you're saying, like I went to Bug Jar once, and I went to one at Monty's. What's it called now? Monty's Corner? Monty's? I don't even know. But that place, both those places were the two times where I felt skeeved out. Like, I had the mask on and everything too. And it's just a small room with a lot of people, you know? It's just,
I'm still not quite, you know. We got a show. So John and I have a duo called Beast View Mall, like, I don't know, free noise, whatever, improv. And so us and Nod and Will Veeder had a show set up back. We were going to do it at the Psychic Garden back in the fall, and then something came up and we had to reschedule it, and Psychic Garden shut down for the winter because it's not heated or anything. So then we were trying to book it, and there was a couple of venues that came up like Monty's and stuff, and I'm like, I'm not comfortable like playing there, because that's when, you know, the rates are going up. It was before Omicron, but the rates were still going up, and once Omicron hit, we're like, I'm not playing any bar like that. You know, I had a really sort of trust where we were going, because, you know, I mean, I'm full vax and stuff, but like we're around relatives and stuff that are older, so we were just being careful about it. And everyone in the band, like, you know, we're older guys, and and we, you know, if we have any relatives around, they're all old too, so we wanted to be careful about it. So yeah, so we have that show actually finally booked again at Abilene at the end of March. So I'm psyched about that. And then Crush to Hunta, which is an Urbanum in with Chris Rieg and Dennis Mariano. And that's like improv loud rock, essentially. We play and people don't know it's improv because we more or less play songs, but we're just making them up. And somehow we fake it good enough. So we're trying to set up a show probably in April or something with some other band like Pomelo. I'm talking to those guys. I don't know if you know those guys at all. They're like, it's funny. There's like all these Chicago, like loud rock, math rock bands in town now. Like those guys I know, but they started telling me about all these other bands we should get to play the show with us. And I'm like, they're all young kids, you know, but I'm like, God, like I would have died if we had bands like that around when Hilke's around. Like we had no one like us to play with us, you know, which, you know, it's fine playing with other, you know, different bands, but we're always kind of looking for kindred, you know, bands.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like our hardcore scene's like that now too, because there's not really like a lot of young kids here, but like whenever the bands play, they're like older people. And I'm like, man, these guys all just like in like 2007, 2008, they all sprouted up. And now like there was a couple years there where I was calling them like new or young kids and they were laughing. They're like, we're not young. You must've just not realized when we came around or whatever, you know? And I'm like, there was a couple years there, I guess.
Funny to hear you talk about the young kids being around, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's what I was laughing about too. Putting the Zoom on. I'm like, man, I never had any gray hair or a gray beard any years that I knew you before or anything. So it's, you know, now I have kids and everything too. So, and that's one thing.
I have an embarrassing story though. I got to tell you. So I used to see at shows and you booked us at your grandmother's basement. I think what might've been the first time we played a show with you. Or like a show you booked. And then me and my girlfriend were at Marketplace Mall at the food court the one day, and it was like late in the summer and we're just eating there. And all of a sudden I look out the window, you know, Marketplace Mall food court, remember there was like all those glass windows. And all of a sudden I see you walking up with, it was your mom or your grandmother or something. And you saw me and you just looked so embarrassed because like you were going like back to school shopping or something, right? And you're just like, you know, you were out of your element. We were both out of our element, right? But you just, I just remember you looking kind of like, oh, fuck. Like,
I can't like, wait to see if my kids are like that. That's the kind of stuff I think about now. Like, and I'm sure you're the same way, like having kids now. It's like, I wonder, like we got into the parenting game really late. You know, I was like 37 when we had our first kid. So I imagine I'm going to be like in my 50s and my son's going to be like going to high school. Like, get away from me, dad. Like, what do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just like, that was actually my next question before you started talking about that I was thinking about is like you having kids and like a family and stuff. Like, do you ever play them the music and like, what are their thoughts on like?
Oh yeah. I was just going to say that. Yeah, no, they think I'm an idiot. It's sort of the reverse of the normal, you know, the parent is like, what's that racket? What are you playing? That's just noise. It's the opposite. So I'm playing stuff and my son and my daughter's a little better now. My son's still sort of in that realm of like, what is that? That's not music. And I'm like, what are you talking? And it's like totally normal stuff. Like in my realm, you know, it's not noise, but yeah, it's hilarious that we have this role reversal, but like my daughter started doing this. So she's 19 now. She started doing this a number of years ago, and now Leo, my son, is doing it, where they start playing me stuff. You go, oh, I think you'll like this. You know, it'll be some like new band that's sort of edgier sounding or whatever like that. So they're trying to turn me onto it, and then I'm like, you know, they sound like so and so, and I'll play them, you know, something different. But
you ever like any of the stuff that they play for you though, or not really?
I do. Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember years ago my daughter. She got really into 21 Pilots when they first came out.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's kind of fun stuff. You know, it's like, I don't even know what you would describe, you know, they kind of like rip off reggae-ish type stuff, you know? And then he raps a little bit, but then he's got a ukulele, you know? And we went to see him live in Buffalo and it was a good show. But they did all these weird droney noise things in between songs while they were changing things up. I'm like, oh, this is the good stuff. And she's like, what are you talking about? They're not playing anything. I'm like, no, this is the good stuff. Billie Eilish was somebody she turned me on to. That I heard that record, I was like, holy crap, that's great. Her and her brother. Those are the standouts, I think. She's really into there was like Olivia Rodriguez and the Hallows is a band. It's a couple dudes. And there's this another band, is three girls, and I think they're sisters. They were in that recent movie, Licorice Pizza. Do you know this movie?
No.
It's like an indie movie. I mean,
I think I have heard of it, actually, now you mentioned it.
Yeah, it probably win like a Golden Globe or something. It's not like super underground. But they were in that as a band. And I think the one girl was an actress in it, like a character in it. I forget what they're called, though. Yeah, and there's another band she listens to a lot, too. She's always playing for me. Ravenettes or something.
I've heard the name, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I think it's four women. It's kind of post-punk sort of sounding stuff, you know? Yeah. But they get a little rockabilly at times, which I don't really like. But
yeah. I mean, I grew up on like 90s rap and stuff, so I'm just really worried that like a lot of the rap that comes out now is really terrible. So I'm just worried that in 10 years it's going to be even worse, and my son's going to listen to that, and it's going to be similar to what you're saying, but worse. Like he's going to be playing, I'm going to be like, hold on a second, like this is the real shit here, you know? But I don't know. Yeah, maybe there'll be something good by then, you know? Who knows?
I just watched a comedian that was talking about that. So he was talking about rap, and he's super into, he's an older guy. So he's, of course, was into it back in the 80s. And so he's like, you know, back then they all had to be really good to get signed, because like no labels wanted to sign any rap guys. And so he's like, you knew the 17 rap groups that were out. Like there was 17 of them, and he started listing like EPMD and, you know, LL Cool J and Big Daddy Kane and MC Light, you know, and so he names all these things, and they're rappers I know of too, because growing up in that era. And he's like, now it's like, it's the problem is there's so many of them. Of course, there's going to be a lot of shit. Like every other genre, you think about every other genre, you know, that is very popular, you're going to have a lot of crap. And you really need to dig to find the good stuff, you know? You think about even hair metal. So me and my son have been watching Peacemaker. You know this show?
Nah.
So it's a DC character. He was in Suicide Squad. John Cena plays Peacemaker.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it's fucking great. Like they really nailed the corny, campy, like D-level comic character. Like he's not a famous comic book dude, and the soundtrack is all these hilariously horrible hair metal songs, which I thought were all faked, but they're not, they're all real. The guy just went and found D-level hair metal bands. So you think about, you know, hair metal, like that's what made the record labels money back in the 80s. So they, you know, there was a billion of those bands, and not many of them were very good, you know. I mean, you can argue that none of them are good, but there's, you know, Cinderella, you know, wrote good songs, I thought, right? Bon Jovi, love him or hate him, wrote good songs. But, you know, you think about, you know, it's a gigantic genre, and of course it's going to be mostly shit, you know? Hardcore probably was like that in the 90s and 2000s. Tons of hardcore bands, you know, a couple dozen gems, right? I listen to hardcore, and I'm like, even back then, they sound like the other hardcore, you know, but I'm not exposed to it enough to figure out the differences. Most people say that about the music I listen to, you know?
Well, that's actually something I wanted to correct myself on. You probably never even caught it. When I was first corresponding to you about doing this interview, I said I wanted to talk to you about the label and everything you do. And I was like, not hardcore per se, or like not exactly hardcore, but like, as you referenced with the Pengo shit, like that's like, even though it might sonically not be like hardcore, like what you guys are going for is like, in like the ethics and like the ideas, like that pretty much is like as hardcore as it gets, pretty much, you know what I mean? Like pushing the boundaries and
back when I first started playing, I had my buddy Rob would talk about that too, on what like punk was. This conversation would go on in this mailing list on like what punk was, right? And I feel like what we've always done is punk, you know? We don't sound punk. We do not look punk, you know? I think, you know, most punk, I think, is for better or worse, a costume, you know. But you can say that about me. I wear stupid band shirts all the time and stuff like that. But, you know, the idea of like we've it's all DIY. Politically, we're all left wing. Granted, not all punk is left wing. You know, so there's the aesthetics around punk and the DIY thing. And, you know, Fugazi aren't punk. They don't sound punk, you know. They for me, that's emo. That's what emo is, right? And then emo became something else after that. But for me, that's what emo is. Like writing songs about, you know, emotional stuff and political stuff and social stuff, which, you know, Hilke didn't, we never sang about. Like most of our lyrics were completely absurdist. But it was also that. It was also like we're trying to push a little boundary with this absurdity, you know, even with the music too and the organ and shit like that. And Pango, of course, is John would have probably a big philosophical debate over me. Like we talk about like Pango, we've talked about, he uses the word actions a lot, which is like a Viennese art movement thing. But it's all about that. It's like about the act of that doing and pushing a boundary and some weird process. I'm getting that wrong, I'm sure, but.
I mean, obviously I want to start profiling more of the early Rochester hardcore scene. So John's definitely somebody I want to reach out to at some point.
Oh
to,
God, yeah.
To get on here for an interview, yeah. You know, and he's like you, somebody I'd want to have on here a couple of times because I don't want to like gloss over anything. You know what I mean? Like sometimes right. When I have people on here, like I've had people on here recently that have done like 10 to 15 hardcore bands. And we talk about them all in like an hour and a half. And I'm like, afterwards, I'm like, I feel like I kind of did us both a disservice there. You know what I mean? So that's why when I was talking to you before, I was like, let's do a couple bands tonight. And then maybe in a few months down the road, try to talk some more type thing. You know what I mean? Right. So,
yeah. I mean, John would be great. Cause he's, you know, he's got all that information from when he was in Solution and then Powerline, you know, those two bands alone in that era, are just great to hear. He just put out a zine. I don't know if you know about this. It's kind of part of his radio show. So we both have radio shows over at WAO and, part of a fundraising thing, trying to raise money in the fall during our campaign. We like, if people donate a certain amount, say, and mention my show, they get a shirt. His show this year, usually it's mixtapes that he makes for you. But this year was a zine and he just put it out this past week. And, in there, he told a story that he's told to me in person before of like digging for records and finding these crazy records at a Salvation Army, you know, basement. So he's got all these great stories like that, that he somehow remembers, you know, from the Solution was his band before Powerline, and then Powerline was the one with, you know, Mike Honch, and Zach Baracus, you know, who then went on to be in Jawbox and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that'd be a few episodes. Cause even like Shop Class Square is like, that's another band that for me, like,
yeah, right. Yeah.
First got into the scene. Like that was one of my favorite local bands. And like, when I look back now on it, and I always say like my favorite bands, I always think of like hardcore bands or whatever, but like, that's a band that definitely, I mean, a lot of you guys, you know what I mean? Like that show I referenced earlier from 95, like that was like my gateway pretty much to this whole thing. You know, I guess I can kind of thank you guys for, depending on how you want to look at it, you know what I mean? You know, for all these years, you know? So, but yeah, like I said, I want to get you on again eventually. I think that kind of wraps up what I had for topics for tonight, but is there anything that we didn't like talk about that you'd want to throw in there?
No, there's, I don't know, a billion things.
And that's what I was going to say too. I always tell my guests that I'm going to throw their links in with the show notes. I'm sure we'll figure out how to find how many links you want to put in with the show notes tonight and stuff. You know, we have a few days to figure that out. So, but yeah. And is there anything else you want to plug? Anything coming up or anything? Or
no, like I said, March 25th at Abilene, Nod is playing, Will Veeder, who is, he was in Mueller and then he started Hinckley and he had the band Hinckley for years. And now he's solo. I'm going to do some percussion with him, but it's a solo act. And then BC Mall, which is me and John. So that's Abilene on 25th. That's all we have booked right now. Like I said, I'm trying to set up a Crush the Hunter show, probably April or May. And then Pango, I'm working on Pango shows for a weekend later in the summer. We're going to probably go to like Kingston, New York and Philly. play some shows out of town.
Nice.
Yeah, we did that summer 2019, I guess. We played like Kingston and New Haven, Connecticut, and Brooklyn. And then we were going to do in 2020, and that didn't happen. And we didn't even think about last year, 2021, you know. So right now we're like, I'm booking some shows. I'm talking to venues that are finally booking and stuff. So
yeah, fingers crossed. Everything seems like on the up and up though. Like I've been on the fence about booking shows for, you know, pretty much the same period of time you've been talking about. And I feel more comfortable like looking towards like the summer or the fall now. So I think I'm going to do the same.
Yeah.
You know? So
yeah.
Yeah, no, like I said, I appreciate you doing the interview and everything. And I definitely want to have you on again at some point to kind of cover more of the bases with all the other fun projects you've had going on over the years.
Yeah, so. Sure.
All right.
Yeah, cool. It was great catching up with you, man.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So I think that's going to wrap up episode 64. I want to thank Joe for doing the interview. As always, thanks to Rob, Greg, and Jim for helping out with the podcast. Thanks to my family for the support. Check out enterprisehardcorepodcast.com for the next episode. See everybody real soon and stay safe.
I got one more thing to plug. I forgot.
Go ahead.
I got a podcast.
And oh, I forgot to ask you about that the whole time. My bad.
That's all right. I'll give you a link to it.